You are listening to Truth to You with Jono on the Meander Radio Network. Remember, all programs are archived and available to download at truthtoyou.org. That's truth, number two, letter U, dot org. G'day to everybody listening around the world, and thank you for your company. Joining me this hour is Baruch Ben Daniel of the website aent.org. Baruch, welcome to the program.
Shalom, and thank you very much.
Thank you for coming on.
Great to be here.
I think it might be beneficial, Baruch, perhaps if you could begin by telling the listeners about the AENT. What does that stand for?
That's the Aramaic English New Testament. Mm-hmm. And it's the oldest Aramaic New Testament scripts that are available currently. And I got interested when I heard the Koboros Codex. Koboros Codex was first brought into America in 1954. And that inspired me to get involved with Andrew Gabriel Roth. Mm-hmm. And he had been working on translation for some time before that, but before, you know, I had heard about him. And with a group on Peshitta.org, Paul Union and a group of who are called Aramaic Primacists. Mm-hmm. And so in around 2004, 2005, Andrew had done a lot of the translation work. I was going to put up on the internet just as a, just an outline of some of his texts. And we began putting a full study edition out around 2005, 2006. And then we published it in 2008. So it's from the Koboros Codex. The colophon of the Koboros Codex indicates that it was dated 100 years after the Great Persecution. And scholars believe that was the persecution of 64, Nero, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. which would put that text at 164.
Right, okay. And so now, just for the listeners who don't know, can you elaborate a little bit on the Koboros Codex and the, what did you mention, the colophon?
The colophon is when scribes put their information, their names, the location, mm-hmm. of the manuscript, and if they're making a copy of where that copy, where the original that they're using, mm-hmm. came from, as much information that they need to maintain the custody, the transmission or the line of custody of text, the recognition of the text. The Church of the East was very particular about their sacred texts.
Right.
And so they had a very unique way of monitoring who the scribes were and which locations they were delivered to and when they're delivered to those locations.
Right. So is it fair to say, Baruch, that it is like the publishing details of the actual publication, if you like?
Certainly. Yeah. Exactly.
Okay.
What made it interesting for me is I had heard about Peshitta and Lamza and different versions. But when the Koboros Codex was first made public, there was a heightened bit of interest among the Aramaic community to look at it, to examine it, to compare it with the text that they already have. Mm-hmm. And what happened was when they looked at it, they said, this is essentially the family, almost precisely the same as the family they had retained for 1,800 years, approximately 360 manuscripts. Mm-hmm. And so, so it really wasn't a big deal for them, uh-huh. but it was a huge deal for me.
Because, if I understand you correctly, you're saying there were 360-odd manuscripts of the Peshitta text, the Aramaic. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Correct,
okay,
yeah.
And this one came to light, at least in the States, in the mid-1900s. Is that...
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Okay, and although it was almost pretty much word for word for in regards to the other 360 other texts that were available, this one was of particular interest to you. Why was that?
Well, for a few reasons. It's impeccably preserved, and because it validated the other manuscripts, and because of the people like Andrew Gabriel Roth and others who were working on it, they started doing literal translation of it. And this was the first time I and many others had actually seen a literal word-for-word translation of the Aramaic New Testament.
Right.
Without having some, priest, some Catholic priest, put his notes or his ideas or or write with his Greek, you know, kind of perspectives, just put that into the English text, right? This was just the raw Aramaic.
Right. It came to light in the U.S. in the mid-1900s. Prior to that, was it subject to scholarly scrutiny? I mean, or was it something that was discovered only recently? What's the history of the document?
The history of this particular document, it was in Kurdistan. It was found in a library in Kurdistan. There's an appendix in the Aramaic English New Testament that explains the Kabbalah's Codex and how it was brought into the United States. And it was revealed to presented to the president, Dwight Eisenhower, and to the White House. And it was a huge fanfare. It made the New York Times and it was called the NT bomb in 1954 in the New York Times. And then very shortly thereafter, it got squashed. It was just too politically incorrect for the religious community.
Really?
And
what do you put that down to?
Well, I think that question is best left to the Church of these people themselves. I mean, they've maintained a continuous custody of their New Testament texts, but they haven't really been recognized by the greater Greek speaking or Greek primacy community. I really don't know why that is. I mean, the Aramaic, in so many ways, upholds Greek text, and there's so many places in the Aramaic actually can show the root of some of the Greek text families. So I would think that a Greek primacist would be excited about this text because it validates the authority of the New Testament in a magnificent way. But you know. Okay, to put that question in modern day context, I think it's a matter of politics, religion, and money.
Truly.
And just in the last few years, being a publisher, I wasn't a publisher until I met Andrew Gaber Roth.
Okay.
It's amazing how when you meet with different distributors and bookstores and whatnot, they say, well, you know, nobody knows about that text, and it's really not, you know, bona fide authorized by the pastor at the local church or by such and such evangelist. And who's this guy, Andrew Gabriel Roth? I mean, nobody's heard of him, so, you know, we have a whole new cadre of Bibles coming out for this next season. So, you know, we're not really interested in that. And I've had, you know, when I first started doing door-to-door, knocking on, you know, the bookstore doors, I got the response that, you know, Bibles really don't sell as much as they used to. We're more interested in Christian fiction now than Bibles.
Isn't that amazing?
Oh, I kid you not. It just blew me away.
Yeah, no, it's a sad and sorry state of the reality of things, unfortunately.
Yeah, for sure.
As far as the Kabbalah's Codex is concerned, though, I mean, you say it was found in a library in Kurdistan. Is that correct?
Yeah, it was found in a small church library.
Is there now that it's been subject to scrutiny, experts looking at it and so forth, surely there are some scholars from recognized universities that are giving credit and credence to this document?
Oh, for sure. Yeah, if you go on the internet and just type in Aramaic, you know, primacy and just query Google. I've found over a dozen books of mainstream PhD Greek primacists who have endorsed the Aramaic as the original text.
Okay, because I actually own a copy of it. I'm holding it now. I think I've had mine for almost a year.
Okay, wonderful.
The AENT, and it's a beautifully finished product too. But I was scanning through the beginning to see if I could find a record of that. But you don't have details of names of scholars from recognized universities that are talking up this particular Kabbalah's Codex, or have I missed it?
No, we didn't put that within the Bible itself. But that might be a great idea. There's, like I said, as far as I know, just on the internet right now, there's publications. I suppose we could put up a page of all the publications for you.
No, I thought I'd look for that, but I couldn't find it. So, well, I tell you what, we could talk a little bit more about it, but really the website has a plethora of information, doesn't it? And once again, for the listeners, it is aent.org, and that's available there. But what we might do, if it's okay, Baruch, is jump into the topic at hand. And really, the reason why you and I are talking is because you came onto my website and left a comment. If I can read that, it says, "Shalom, everyone. Interesting bunch of dialogue." And this, of course, was in response to the discussion between myself and Keith Johnson and Nehemiah Corden just a couple of weeks prior. He writes, "Interesting bunch of dialogue. I was the one who instigated the debate." And so you are the gentleman who is the instigator of the events past in regards to that discussion. And you continue saying, "I have the documentation to prove that Mr. Nehemiah Corden is misrepresenting the nature of my request through GLC. I asked for a debate on textual criticism. Mr. Corden is running like a scared little pussycat from my request for him to debate Aramaic versus New Testament primacy." You go on to say, "Did you hear that? Mr. Nehemiah Corden is afraid to, quote-unquote, destroy Andrew. Wow. Bring it on then. Why don't you, dear Nehemiah? There's lots more to come, folks, and I'm available for a nice, pleasant chat about this just about any time. Todol Rapa." And so here we are, my friend. We're here having a nice, pleasant chat, and I appreciate you getting in contact so that we can unpack this a little bit further. Now, that was also accompanied with an article that you wrote, which is also available to read on aent.org. And the article is entitled Karaism and Nehemiah Corden, which is obviously a reply to the Aramaic Letter Exposed, which is the article that Nehemiah wrote, which is available to read on aprayertoourfather.org. Now, where shall we begin? I'm going to let you do that.
It's actually only posted on HebrewNewTestament.com.
Oh, my apologies. HebrewNewTestament.com is...
No worries.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is where they can and go to read that. Okay.
Yeah, there's no specific... There's links within the body of the text that go to the Karaites page, but it's not a big featured part of the Hebrew New Testament discussion, but, you know, I was upset when I heard... The radio broadcast, a brother had emailed me the link, and I was very upset and very, very sad.
It does read to be an emotive and impulsive response. Is that fair?
Yeah. I mean, we all have our emotions, and mine were quite peaked when I wrote that. So, you know, I met Nehemiah in Jerusalem some years ago. Mm-hmm. When he first published his book, the Hebrew Yeshua or the Greek Jesus?
Yes, so I was pretty excited. The Hebrew Yeshua versus the Greek Jesus. That's correct.
Right. Yeah. So I was pretty excited about him taking, you know, a scholarly academic role within the New Testament as a Karaite. I had a Karaite roommate in Jerusalem, and learned a bit about Karaism. And so I had purchased about a dozen copies of his book and was sharing them around with different family and friends. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And, you know, I disagreed with his thesis, and I'll get into that with you here. But
sure.
But we, over the period of time discussing Aramaic versus Shem Tov, I couldn't get much of a discussion going with him, and I've tried over the few years, and I've got some emails in front of me here that I sent last year to Nehemiah, and I reached out in a very contrite way. You know, I just didn't feel I was being inciting anything. I can read little bits of it here, I'll read it all for you, but I asked him, "Dear Nehemiah, Todah Rabah for the link. You know, I read his February 22nd newsletter. And I said, pardon me for all the questions. I'm writing an article about Karaite Judaism from a Netzri perspective." Mm-hmm. And I asked a few questions. "In your opinion, does Paul do away with Torah and circumcision? I asked because you stated in your presentation, the Netzari Jews continue to remain as Jews, continue to practice certain Jewish ritual, such as circumcision. And he had told me that Meir Ragavi was the Hakam, one of the Karaite scholars in California, that would be good to dialogue with. When I tried contacting Meir, and there was no reply from him either. So, and I asked Nehemiah, I'm just wondering, do Karaites have any unique reasons for disbelief in Yeshua's Mashiach? Mm-hmm. And from studying his material, the only things I could find were the basic rabbinical arguments against Yeshua. And I was hoping that he had something different and unique to put on the table. Sure. And now I know that he doesn't. He mm-hmm. said that on your radio show that he doesn't, but mm-hmm. I didn't know at that time.
Sure.
And then I said, have you written any articles where you've employed Hebrew New Testament primacy perspectives as it pertains to Torah observance for non-Jews, mm-hmm. or opposing New Testament anti-Semitism, etc.? And the reason I said that, I asked him that, is because we found a whole bunch of stuff in the Aramaic that showed us that the anti-Semitism with, you know, real or unfounded, that it was in the Greek New Testament text, did not appear in the original Aramaic text.
Right.
And mm-hmm. I thought this would be a boon for, you know, Nehemiah and those around him to understand the more accurate elements of the New Testament.
Sure.
And then, I went on that I watched the symposium. I was there on the camera when Nehemiah and Keith Johnson and, you know, Andrew Gabriel Roth was actually the last speaker, and Dr. Russ Hills spoke. I was videoing all that material, and mm-hmm. and you know, some of the statements he made, Nehemiah made about the Netzari or the Nazarenes being persecuted into extinction. He said this is a fact of history, and I thought, oh well, could you explain that history? Because, you know, the history that I have doesn't exactly say that. It says the Netzari, the Jewish believers in Yeshua, went underground mm-hmm. in about the 4th century, and you can imagine why they did under Constantine.
But the fact of the matter
is we have evidence all through church history mm-hmm. of non-Jewish and non-Jewish followers of Yeshua that were Torah observant. They kept the Shabbat. They loved the Moedim. They loved Yahweh's feasts.
Now, may I clarify something, Baruch? Is this, just to be clear, as is the name of the publishing company that you run, Netzari Press?
Correct.
Can I just, before we continue along this line, just so listeners understand, Netzari, what does that mean? What does it represent?
Well, it's based on the word from Isaiah 11:1. Mm-hmm. And here, I'll just go read it for you real quick. So the Netzer mm. is a little sprout that comes out of the root. It says, it's but a branch will emerge from the trunk of Yishai, a shoot will grow from its roots. And the spirit of Yahweh will rest on him, the spirit of wisdom and understanding, the spirit of counsel and power, the spirit of knowledge and fearing Yahweh. Mm. He will be inspired by fearing. I'm reading from, I just grabbed David Stearns here. I kind of grabbed one of two or three others, but I kind of like this one because he says a shoot
yes.
will grow from, and that is actually a good way of explaining the Netzer.
Mm-hmm.
And this little tiny shoot grows from these roots, and then we have these seven attributes. And everybody knows that this is Mashiach. The Jewish, the Orthodox world knows this. The Kabbalists know this. Everybody knows. We're talking Mashiach here. This is part of the Sefirot. You know, I mean, I don't want to get into a bunch of Kabbalah here, but it's part of the attributes of Yahweh revealed in Mashiach
mm-hmm.
that make up the tree of life, if you will.
Okay.
And the harmonization of all things, the Teferet, of all things between the spiritual worlds and the natural world, the physical, the soul, the body, mind, all these things are combined in Mashiach.
Right.
The Mashiach is the connection of all these. So that Netzer, Paul was called a ringleader of the Nazarenes.
Yes, Acts 24.
Correct. And so many people think, oh, that's because Yeshua lived in Nazareth. Mm. You know, he was called a Nazarati, lived in Nazareth. Well, not really. He he had a much higher divine kind of a label, prophetic label put on him. Mm-hmm. And that comes right here from Yeshayahu 11:1.
Now, there's an allusion to that, isn't there? Or my understanding is that Matthew, in his second chapter, that is the last verse of 22, verse 23, and he came and dwelt in a city called Nazareth, that it might be fulfilled, which was spoken by the prophets, he shall be called a Nazarene. Is that
that's
the connection there?
Yes and no. In this particular one, he should be called a Nazariah. Yes. It's got the same play on words. There's actually a footnote there. Are you reading the AENT?
No, that one wasn't. I've got the AENT open elsewhere, but I'll find it in the AENT, and it says in the AENT of Matthew 2, verse 23, I have, and he came and dwelt in the city that is called Nazareth, so that it might be fulfilled the thing which was spoken by the prophet, that he will be called a Nazarea.
Okay, now you can go ahead and read that footnote on 22.
Yeah, and there's a footnote on 22. An example of singular plural confusion in Greek. In Aramaic, prophet, inverted commas, is spelt the same in both singular and plural forms, whereas Hebrew has distinct forms. Greek translators choose to translate this as prophets, in the plural, but only one prophet, Isaiah 11:1, and there we go, refers to Mashiach as Netzur, which is Hebrew for young shoot or sprout. A closer look at Isaiah 11:1-4 reveals the spiritual branches of the menorah as attributes of Mashiach. Netzur is the basis for the name Nazareth, which at that time was a very small village in the land of Israel. Other prophets reveal Mashiach as the branch, but use the Hebrew, now how would I pronounce that? Zimach?
Zimach, uh-huh. Yes.
Thus eliminating the obvious wordplay here by Matthew. The prophet Daniel also uses the word Netzur, but not in connection, not in the context of messianic prophecy. There we go. So we have Netzur. Now, is there a reason for... So Netzur and Netzari is... they're the same word. Are we talking about an Aramaic?
Yes.
So it's the
No, that's the same. That's the same word. But like this was saying, this is forms the basis of a lot of other Nazrati, Nazraya, Nazarite.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so that's where that comes from. And now you would claim to be, and I'm guessing also Andrew Gabriel Roth. Would claim to be Netzari, Jewish Netzari believers. Is that a fair way to...
Absolutely. Yes.
And in a nutshell, that would be those who believe in Yeshua as Messiah and keep the commandments of Elohim. Is that fair, if I had to put it in a nutshell?
That's beautifully said. Those who sing the song of Moshe and have the testimony of the Lamb.
Okay. All right. Mm-hmm. This is where I... Just so we all... listeners understand, so I understand. And you were reading, before I interrupted you, you were going through the email and touching on a couple of those things.
Well, yeah, so we were looking at some of these ideas in the email and trying to find them and compare some of the apologetics, if you will, between the Aramaic and the Greek texts.
Right.
You know, so...
Right. And also between the Aramaic and the Shem Tov Hebrew Matthew, am I to understand that correctly?
Yes, correct. Yes, and at that time, that was actually the last bit of email I got from Nehemiah was a few days later in February last year, where he basically said, "Well, it sounds like you're preparing an article to this, and your past email sound like you are preparing an article bashing Karaite Judaism."
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking, "Oh, okay." Well, I guess that's as far as that goes.
Well, I mean, this was after 2009. This was after the events at the symposium.
This was just a week after.
Okay, right. This was just a week afterwards. And he claimed to have experienced a negative situation there at the symposium, and perhaps his reaction to your email, I'm guessing, may have reflected that, but it is, I guess, what you, if I understand you correctly, you're trying to get more information in regards to Shem Tov's Hebrew Matthew. You'd like to see it debated against the Peshitta text because, if I understand you correctly, you're calling into question its authority. Would that be fair?
Oh, that's absolutely. Let me give you a little bit of background on Shem Tov, who he is, and this manuscript. And I'm going to just use what 99.99% of the scholars out there support. You know, there's always going to be a one or two who has, you know, ideas that, you know, usually aren't very sustainable. But this is I think I put this up on the web, but I'm just going to read little parts of it here for you.
Sure.
Shem Tov, his name was Ben Yitzhak Shaprut of Tudela, was born in Tudela in the middle of the 14th century. Mm-hmm. That's Tudela, Spain, of course, now northern Spain by the Pyrenees Mountains. He was a Spanish Jewish philosopher, a physician, and a polemicist, master of polemics, you know. Mm-hmm. So when he was still a young man, he was compelled to debate in public on original sin and redemption with Cardinal Pedro de Luna, afterwards with anti-Pope Benedict VIII. And this disputation took place in Pamplona in December 26, 1375, in the presence of all sorts of bishops and theologians. So what he did to actually prepare himself for this is he wrote his own copy of the Hebrew New Testament.
Sure.
And he was a Talmudic scholar, and he was his polemic work was against baptized Jews, against Jews who come to know Yeshua. Mm-hmm. So in order to assist the Orthodox Jewish world in their polemical writings, he translated the four Gospels into Hebrew, and then he accompanied them with his own observations, right? So sure. When Nehemiah brought his book out, you know, specifically based on Matthew 23:1, Yeshua then spoke with the crowds. Actually, let me do this here in the Aramaic. Okay. So let's look. Haydin Yeshua Malel Am, then while Yeshua spoke among the crowds, Kinsei Wa Am, Talmudohi, and among his disciples. Am, of course, here is among the crowds, like Amanuel, like Emmanuel.
Sure.
Verse 2, Weimar Lachon Al, and then said upon them, Kur Si'a, throne, or seat of throne power. The Moshe Yitabo. And then the verse 3 is Kolmadim Hachil Dene Amron Lachom Daitit Ron Tero, as all things as they would say them, that Dait Ron they Tero say to you, what if though that they Yech should Tero guard, what if though and do Ich. Okay, so the idea here is, and then, you know, Haki, my Aramaic is, I'm not Andrew Gaber Roth, I'm just the publisher here.
Sure.
All things that were made by him is called Madim, right? The word for everything, and Avedon, these deeds, Dale, Tebon, these deeds are not, Amrin, for they talk, Gir, for Wela, Avdin, they do. Okay. So basically, it's exactly what every Greek text and what every Aramaic text says, except for one text, Shem Tov's text, where in verse 3, therefore everything he says that you should keep and do.
Right.
Okay. So, you know, and anybody who's a Torah observant scholar knows that on the basis of two or three witnesses, the matter shall be established.
Mm.
So to actually take one text that most scholars prove to be a 13th century medieval text and use that to build a whole book on is a lie. It's a fabrication. It's a falsehood. And the reason we know that is because look at the rest of the verses. Okay, so I've got, if anybody listening has got their Bible handy, just follow along here. Then spake Jesus to the multitude and to his disciples, saying, the scribes and the Pharisees sit in Moses' seat. And therefore, whatever they bid you observe, that observe and do. Mm. But do not ye after their works. So in verse 3, we have they, as in they sit in Moses' seat, and bid you observe that, observe and do. But do not ye... let me just read it from there, Mick. There's too many that's and thous. But do not according to their deeds, for they talk but do not. Verse 4, and they bind heavy burdens and place them upon the shoulders of the sons of men, but they do not desire to touch them with their finger, with their fingers. Okay, let me just look at that one too. Verse 5, and they do all their deeds that they might be seen by the sons of men. For they widen their tefillin and lengthen the tekelet of their robes, and they love the chief places in festivals and the chief seats in the assembly.
Sure.
Okay. Mm. How many theys and theirs did we just read?
You know, there's quite a number of them. So if I'm to understand what you're saying is that if I'm to understand that you're saying that the Shev Tov Hebrew Matthew in this regard is incorrect by using the word he, then by staying with the word they, would you say that the understanding of the verse differs from the understanding that they are reading Moses, therefore do what Moses says to do? Or would you suggest that we are to listen to the Pharisees and do what they tell us to do from this text so that I understand where you're going?
Well, whether it's he, Moshe, or they, ultimately doesn't make a lot of difference, because the point is that, you know, they sit in Moses' seat, and what Moses, which means the seat, I didn't emphasize that actually when we were reading it in the Aramaic, the word for seat is kursia, throne, and that's the word kisei, Hebrew, is mentioned all through scriptures as throne. In Genesis 41:40, thou shalt be over my house according to your word shall all my people be ruled. Only in the throne, kisei, will I be greater than thou. Of course, that's talking about, you know, Pharaoh and Joseph, right? So, so the point here is that when the Pharisees are actually teaching from the seat or from the throne of Moshe, when it's actually his... when it's his authority, his word, then do what they do. But when they're following Torah al peh, their own traditions, don't do what they're doing.
Am I to understand, do I understand correctly, Baruch, that when they are sitting in the throne of Moshe, they can only speak from the written Torah? Is that correct?
Sorry, that they can only speak from the written Torah?
They can only read from the written Torah when they're sitting on the throne of Moshe? Have I understood that correctly?
Well, ideally, yes. I mean, that's what Yeshua was teaching here.
Okay, so when they're sitting on the throne of Moshe, to listen, do what they say, because, if I may elaborate, because they're speaking the written words of Moshe, but do not do what they do, and so on and so forth. And obviously, obviously the Pharisees only sit there one at a time. It's not as if, you know, when he says they're there's two or three or four of them sitting on Moses' throne, reading from the articles. So when you say that it really comes down to meaning the same thing in the Shem Tov and also in the Aramaic here, why is it such a point of contention for you?
Well, because it was from ideas like this that it was being spun that Yeshua was a Karaite, and that he didn't follow the...
Do you have documentation for that somewhere?
I mean, it's if you go, I can give you the Karaite position is that there, that one of Nehemiah's platforms is, look, Yeshua followed the Torah, he taught the Torah, and he was against the traditions of the Pharisees.
Is that a good or a bad thing, Baruch?
Oh, of course, it's a good thing. It's fantastic that Yeshua's established himself as the King of Kings to bring the Torah, write the Torah on the hearts of everybody, Jew and non-Jewish person alike. Sure. So he is the authority, not the Pharisees, not the Karaites, not the different sects, the Sadducees or whatever, but himself, right? And the a lot of the ideas that the Karaite Judaism have on the internet that I've read is that they claim to be direct lines through the scribes and the Sadducees.
Sure.
And I'm going, well, that seems like that doesn't fit, because Yeshua didn't follow the Hashkafa, the philosophy, or the Minhagim, or the Halakha of the Sadducees. He was more clearly defined within the Pharisee world.
If I can understand, so, if I can just, I'm trying to understand here, Baruch. Did you say that the Shem Tov of Hebrew Matthew can be used, because of its wording, to suggest or to say, or has been used to say, that Yeshua was a Karaite? Is that what you said?
That, yeah, and to some degree, that's part of it.
Has Nehemiah Gordon ever written or spoken those words?
I've heard Kares, like I said, I had a Kare roommate.
Nehemiah, for this, I mean, because this is really who we're talking about. Has Nehemiah ever spoken or written those words?
I like to be exact with my quote, sure. So I don't know specifically.
Off the top of your head,
top of my head.
No. The reason why I ask is because I actually asked him that very question, and you can listen to that interview when we discussed the Hebrew Yeshua versus the Greek Jesus, and I'm just going off the top of my head. And if I recall correctly, and please, listeners, you can check this up. If I recall correctly, I asked him, was Yeshua a Karaite? To which his response was, I would say that there was some aspects of Karaite aspects to his message. So he wouldn't say that, he seemed to disagree that he was a Karaite. He wasn't willing to go there with me. So I just want to throw that into the mix. But it seems, if I understand you, Baruch, that because of discrepancies such as this, in the Shem Tov Hebrew Matthew, I mean, in your response to the interview on Truth to You a couple of weeks ago with Nehemiah and Keith, you write in regards to the Shem Tov Hebrew Matthew, you make a note that you quote Nehemiah saying that it's not a translation, but a product of a long process of textual transmission. You go on to say that no lie is of the truth, insinuating that Nehemiah Gordon has lied. But I'm failing to understand what the major problem is here, and where the lie is that Nehemiah has spoken. Would you be able to specify it for me?
Well, specifically, it's called chain of custody.
Mm-hmm.
When a manuscript shows up in the medieval times, 1385,
sure,
and there's no colophon, there's no record of it, there's nothing within it to suggest that it didn't come from any other manuscript except another Greek text. That's a lie. And also going back to whether Nehemiah believes that Yeshua is a Karaite. No, I would never think that he would call a Karaite.
Okay.
But that he was teaching, or his authority was along the lines of Karaism. That's clearly the connection that he has with the Messianic world, with Keith Johnson, and why he's able to come and speak, and many folks have learned, you know, valuable things from the Torah, from Nehemiah.
Mm.
But as a Karaite, what else would be that connection point that if his halakha was so much different? I mean, I don't know how much speaking Nehemiah does in the Orthodox Jewish world, right, in the rabbinical world, how well he's received there. He's been wonderfully received in the Messianic world.
Sure.
And so, you know, in discussions I've had with him personally, there's a lot of stuff we disagree, we agree with, and some, sure, a lot of stuff we disagree with, but there's a lot of points that he makes, brilliant, very good points, about the importance for Torah observance for all those who follow Yeshua. From what I recall, I just thought, right on. It's very, very good, and I support him in bringing all believers into a love for the Torah, to have the Torah written on the heart. Okay, so I just want to clarify that, you know, you know, there's a few other points we'll get into where we disagree, but on that basic you know, need for the word of Yahweh who become flesh and dwelt among us to be written in us, that's right. And so the thing is to say that the Karaites were the only ones who are strictly observing the Torah, I think is a little bit it's an oversimplification.
Okay. So when you that I can get this straight in my head, when you're speaking in your letter, in your article, in regards to Shem Tov's Hebrew Matthew, I mean, let me read it. It says, okay, so most folks who read Mr. Gordon's newsletter would have caught his rhetoric that the Shem Tov Hebrew Matthew is not a translation, but the product of a long process of textual criticism, a textual transmission. It would be lovely if Mr. Nehemiah Gordon would educate everyone as to what, quote, that long process of textual transmission was. Where's the beef, you ask? Would it be too much to ask a notable and capable public orator as Mr. Nehemiah Gordon? I don't think so. No lie is of the truth. Now, that sentence just seems out of place. I'm trying to pinpoint what lie we're talking about here. You continue by saying, I'm no scholar like the big boys. I would just like to know that Mr. Gordon, like to know what Mr. Gordon is talking about. You then go on to refer to somebody and who seems to be irrelevant to the situation by calling him a bumbling idiot. Do I understand that correctly?
Yes, that's correct. Yeah, well, what happened was in the late 90s, a fellow named James Trim came up with the same idea that they had found the not the original, but the Hebrew text that, you know, was brought, you know, from the original autograph, and he made all these claims. James Trim made all these claims about the text, and had all sorts of people ask him for debates. I know two or three of them, and he refused. He refused to provide any kind of historical evidence or scholarly evidence or quotations or reference. Nothing. We got nothing. And so when Nehemiah Gordon came along a few years later and started doing the same thing, I'm thinking, I've seen this movie before.
Sure.
You know, just same movie, different player. So when I quote, he says, not a translation, but a product of a long process, quote, long process of textual transmission. Okay. If he's making that statement, long process, what is, show me the long process. Who are the names? Where? What's the colophon? Who are the people? Where, you know, was it on Mount Sinai that he found it? Was it the Vatinicus? Was it the Alexandria? Where did he find the evidence? I'd love to see it. Everybody would. The whole Messianic community would be delighted to have other evidence for any manuscripts in the New Testament. But when one shows up in Spain, you know, 1360, and then these claims are being made, that's a lie.
Now, he's quoted as saying, and I'll quote him here, as far as Hebrew Matthew is concerned, Keith and I have never claimed it was the original word-for-word Hebrew gospel written 2,000 years ago. In our book and in interviews, we explain that the Hebrew Matthew has gone through a long process of textual transmission. Its importance is that, despite its long transmission, it is not a translation. We encourage people to consider Hebrew Matthew as, quote-unquote, another witness, along with the Greek, Aramaic, and others, to the original words of Yeshua. Now, this is where, if I understand you, Baruch, this is where your problem comes in. You're saying it's not worthy to be recognized as another witness. It's not worthy to be given that kind of credibility, if you like, that kind of authority. Is that fair?
Absolutely not. It's Delitzsch. Franz Delitzsch was open and upfront about his translation of the Hebrew, of the Greek into Hebrew. And the Delitzsch translation is the most commonly used Hebrew New Testament in the Jewish world today, in the Messianic Jewish world today. Boaz, First Fruits of Zion, uses, as from what I've seen on their website, they're Greek primacists. They base their ideas. And there's many others in the Hebraic Roots movement that base their ideas on Greek primacy through the Delitzsch text, and everybody knows, and Delitzsch himself admits that he translated it. So if you want to read about that, that's, again, on HebrewNewTestament.com. Sure. Delitzsch, Franz Delitzsch, the whole story's there. And there's a whole bunch of other things about, you know, Greek and Shem Tov, and there's Shem Tov documents on HebrewNewTestament.com. You can click on the documents, you can look at the Hebrew, and you can compare them for yourself.
Sure. And, so you would claim, obviously, then, that the authority or the weight put on the Shem Tov is unfounded, and that is the problem. So can I ask you this question, Baruch? On the website, aent.org, it states that the Aramaic English New Testament by Andrew Gabriel Roth, the Aramaic English New Testament, the official Messianic Peshitta Study Bible. Now, I guess what I'd like to know, if I may ask, in what sense do you mean the official Messianic Peshitta Study Bible? By what authority does it get labeled as the official?
Well, because it's a study edition. You know, the text speaks for itself. That's why we put the Aramaic alongside the English, so that, you know, that's the text, everybody, and you can compare it with Andrew's translation and see if he's done a fair job. And scholars have done that. Believe me, lots of scholars have done that. I've got a letter on my desk here from the Church of the East, and from other, you know, the top Aramaic scholars on earth. I won't read them. They're personal. If I get permission from them, I'll post them on the internet.
But as far as formal the authority official is concerned, the term official is really not official, if you like. It's not formal, is what we're saying. Is that fair?
Well, let me ask you, what do you think it would take to make it formally official?
I really don't know. That's why I ask.
Well, you know, there's 2,200 different translations of the Bible out there.
Uh-huh.
You tell me, what of all those translations, everybody thinks they've got the best.
Sure. So why would we single one out and say this is the official Messianic Peshitta Study Bible?
Well, because it is. Because it's got, I mean, the people who worked on it have agreed that this is the most ancient and accurate Aramaic text available right now.
Okay.
And if somebody finds another text, you know, maybe they're going to dig one up tomorrow.
Maybe it'll be more official. Let me ask you, Baruch, is it fair to say that this was the catalyst? I mean, this is really the main beef of the situation, if I understand you correctly, for what became the letter or the article that Nehemiah wrote, the Aramaic letter exposed, unfolding the events of the last, I guess, couple of months. Last month or so now, it began with an email, I believe, to Keith Johnson once he had arrived in Jerusalem, saying that his series had been pulled from the television station, that all plans that they had with the television station are now on hold unless he can get his friend Nehemiah Gordon to debate these issues with Andrew Gabriel Roth. And so the quote-unquote, the ultimatum was presented to him. Are you claiming to be the instigator of that particular decision?
Yes. Uh-huh.
Okay. If I may ask, why did you instigate the cancellation of Keith Johnson's series on the name of God in the Hebrew Old Testament if your issue was really the Aramaic versus the Shem Tov Hebrew Matthew, the Hebrew New Testament primacy?
Well, okay, we're talking two different things here. Okay. We're talking Aleppo and Leningrad, and we're talking Shem Tov. So if you want to,
But I guess because you wrote on the website, on my website in the comments, Mr. Gordon is running like a scared little pussycat from my request for him to debate the Aramaic versus Hebrew New Testament privacy. Why then was the Aleppo Codex and the Leningrad Codex brought into question if you really wanted a discussion on Aramaic versus Hebrew New Testament primacy?
Because when you look at quotes in the New Testament from the Tanakh, it can change everything on how the quotes are done in the New Testament and what the authority of the Tanakh, what version of Hebrew Tanakh you're using. And so there was a multi-leveled situation going on.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, you know what? I've got the letters, all of the articles in front of me that were written between the television station and Keith.
Sure.
And the debate was there's no place in the debate in the any letters that the debate was going to be public. In fact, I suggested a public debate, and the people at the TV station weren't comfortable with that.
I thought I read that it was to be a televised debate. I thought that's what you wrote. I thought you said you were the instigator of wanting a televised debate. Did I not read that? Let me just see if I can find that.
Yeah, they were going to put it on, record it, mm-hmm. So that we could have a record of the debate. But whether it was aired or not, that had not been decided. So there was a bunch of things that were going on.
Seems odd.
You know, it's very, very odd.
To record it on TV and but within question as to whether it be aired. Let me ask you this, because I'm confused, and I'm hoping you can help me. The Masoretic text, this is what you wrote. The Masoretic text in your article retained Pharisaical anti-Yeshua rhetoric. Now we're talking about the Leningrad and the Aleppo Codex, right? You wrote the same rhetoric that modern Karaites have totally in common with the big, bad, Orthodox Jewish oral Torah. So are you saying that the version of the Hebrew Bible preserved and used by every Jewish community in the world is contrary to faith in Yeshua?
Not contrary to faith in Yeshua, but there's parts. If we want to look at a couple of elements of that, there's parts of the both in the Hebrew itself and in the translation that have been modified to suit a not so pro Yeshua perspective. So
and you're suggesting that those passages that you're referring to are concur with Shem Tov's Hebrew Matthew.
Yes. Yeah. First of all, this discussion of the Aleppo, me dissing the Aleppo, is unfounded.
Okay.
I mean, I've seen the Aleppo. I've been in Jerusalem, and I can give you plenty of, like, for instance, the Isaiah scroll. When they discovered the Isaiah scroll, I think there was, I've got it written over here, 17 letters different between the Isaiah scroll and the Leningrad Codex.
Mm-hmm.
So, looking at Isaiah 53, just one chapter, Isaiah 53.
Sure.
There's 166 words in Isaiah 53, and there's 10 letters that are spelling differences. 4 letters are stylistic changes. 3 letters where there's an added word. And out of those, there's 17 letters that have no effect on biblical teaching. So when they found the Isaiah scroll, the scholarly world was able to shave about 500 years off of the Aleppo Codex to show that it was extremely accurate in that. But yet, if you look at, for instance, the emendations, are you aware of the 134 emendations that Dr. Ginsburg? Okay, well, let's talk a little bit about that then.
Sure, please.
You know, there's the issues of paleography that I thought would be good to cover, and the textual criticism, and within some of the texts, with specifically the ones that pertain to Mashiach.
Mm.
So, let me just look here. Let's, for instance, the Dead Sea Scrolls. In many instances, the letter Vav is in the Dead Sea Scrolls. Uh-huh. And it's not in the Masoretic text. It's replaced with the Cholam, the Nechud vowel pointing.
Uh-huh.
And for instance, in the Dead Sea Scroll, you have Elohim, which is Aleph, Lamed, Vav, He, Yud, Mem. Mm-hmm. In the Masoretic text, it's Aleph, Lamed, He, Yud, Mem. There's no Vav. It's removed.
Sure.
And so there's in some cases the letter Yud is found in the Dead Sea Scrolls was replaced with Chirach, vowel pointing.
Mm-hmm.
And like in for example, David, Dalet Vav Yud Dalet, and the Masoretic Aleppo is Dalet Vav Dalet. So when I first heard that there was these changes in the Aleppo and the Masoretic text, it blew me away. Mm. It's like, you know, there's yods missing from the Torah, and I think a lot of your listeners, when you say, oh, there's a yod missing, they might think of a scripture, of a verse that Yeshua said in Matthew.
5:17. Yeah.
That's quite a look. Do not think I've come to loosen Torah or the prophets. Mm. I have not come to loosen, but to fulfill. Verse 18. For truly I say to you that until heaven and earth pass away, not one yud or one stroke will pass from Torah till everything happens. I thought, well, isn't that interesting? You think that's a coincidence? That there's a bunch of these little yuds missing from a scroll that shows up 930 years later. And Yeshua said, nothing's going to pass away in heaven and earth. Not one yod or one stroke will pass from Torah.
Right. So in that sense, because of what he said in verse 18 of Matthew 5, in that sense, you might label that as anti-Yeshua. Is that fair? Is that where you're going?
Well, no. I'm just thinking, okay, I mean, whatever the truth is, that's what we're looking for here. We're all seeking, we're sojourners, we're trying to find our way back to the most accurate truth of Scripture. Mm. And then Yeshua, he goes on to say that in here, he says, all who loosen, therefore, from one of these small commandments and teach thus to the sons of men will be called little in the kingdom of heaven, but all who do and teach this will be called great in the kingdom of heaven. For I say unto you that unless your righteousness exceeds more than that of the scribes and the Pharisees, you will not enter the kingdom of heaven. The scribes and the Pharisees, well, isn't that interesting he'd make that mention in the same area where he talks about not one yod or one stroke will pass from Torah, and we know that there's this is exactly what is featured in the Aleppo. And I understand that it's a sensitive. I understand that the Orthodox Jewish world does not like to hear this because of Maimonides, the Rambam, using the Aleppo Codex for the basis of modern Torah scrolls.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I understand that, and I respect that. Okay, but the point is, why can't we discuss these things? Why can't we put these things on the table?
Mm-hmm.
And then rather than look, you know, to some hierarchy who maintains, you know, custody of certain holy texts, you know, personally I look to Yeshua as my authority, not to a hacham, a wise man, a karite, or a great rabbi.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I look to him, and when I read these verses, these speak to me that to listen up here, and if you've got an A&T and you look at the footnotes specifically as it pertains to these issues, you know, we know that Yeshua at no time loosened either the Torah or the prophets, but he was accused of that, right, by his detractors.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that, let me just read this footnote here.
Please.
The prophetic word Yahweh gave to his prophets cannot be loosed or annulled, and neither can the Torah of Yahweh. These are two witnesses that stand as one. The word of Yahweh is both Torah, instruction and righteousness, and prophecy, declaring, foretelling, and revealing the will of Yahweh to each generation. So, unfortunately, this became one of the very, you know, poorly understood parts of the New Testament in the Christian world. And here, fulfill, I have not come to loosen, but to fulfill. Fulfill means to carry out or bring to realization, to perform or do, as in a person's duty, or to obey or follow the commandments, as in satisfying the commandments by obeying them.
Completely.
Okay, so it says Isaiah 42:21, Yahweh is well pleased for his righteousness' sake. He will magnify Torah and make it honorable. You know, and I think about this, I think, yeah, the Torah, the Aleppo, the Leningrad, every Torah scroll in every synagogue and every Messianic community and everywhere is set apart. It's Kadosh LeYahweh. I'm just saying that he magnifies that word, that the living Torah, on our hearts. And so, you know, I think there's a bunch of things going on here that if we start to make the Torah into this whole, to take one, say that the Aleppo Codex is the be-all, end-all, holy grail, I'm thinking, no, I don't think so. I think we've got to look a little bit beyond that here. Isaiah 42 reveals the work of Mashiach. We have full prophetic assurance that Mashiach would never annul Torah. Rather, he magnified Torah and wrote Torah upon the hearts and imaginations of his people. Yeshua carried out in brackets, fulfilled the prophecies regarding Mashiach. He carried them out, made them happen, just like he performed Torah, which was his duty and obligation as Mashiach. Otherwise, he would have not qualified to be Mashiach ben Yosef. Okay, so these elements of the New Testament have prophetic, obviously deep prophetic implications here. And then, you know, it's also, I thought it's interesting where he Yeshua finishes that thought, verse 20. For I say to you that unless your righteousness exceeds more than that of the scribes and Pharisees, you will not enter the kingdom of heaven. Yeshua would certainly not mention the Pharisees in this context, except that they walked in a degree of righteousness.
Mm-hmm.
Most ancient and modern Pharisees, let's call them the Orthodox, have disciplined and righteous lifestyles. Therefore, Yeshua was stating the difference. As the Ruach HaKodesh writes Torah upon the hearts of his followers, they will surpass the righteousness of the Pharisees who elevate tradition rather than Torah.
Mm-hmm.
Those without Torah have no righteousness. They are certainly not borrowing any from Mashiach's righteousness while they continue in sin, regardless of what the theologians have to say. Mashiach imparts his righteousness to those who follow him and keep Torah. Through Yeshua, Yahweh is raising up a standard apart, up a set apart people who keep his commandments rather than making up their own religious traditions. Obviously, that's the point that he's getting at here. Mm-hmm. So, for me, when I first, you know, heard the Dead Sea Scrolls and went to lectures from, you know, Martin Abegg, Peter Flint from the Dead Sea Scrolls team, and looked at the dialogue, I thought that pretty well, you know, everybody in the scholarly world recognized that, you know, that these texts support each other. There's differences within these texts,
right?
But the goal within them is that they support each other, right?
Okay. So the Masoretic texts. Then I suppose my next question, Baruch, would be, why was Nehemiah singled out to defend the Masoretic texts when numerous presenters on this particular television program station refer to it? Why not ask Keith? I mean, it was his series that was currently being aired that was pulled. At your say-so, it would appear.
No. It wasn't my say-so, please.
Oh, okay.
That's not a fair comment.
Sorry, I retract.
I was the instigator in the sense of asking questions to different people at the television station, and based on, you know, what, you know, the authority of the texts were and how they're being used and the name of Yehovah.
Sure.
And I'm pretty new to learning about the people at the TV station. For some reason, I don't know why we can't say GLC, but we all know who it is.
Okay.
But anyways, the discussions.
So they made about, you raised the questions and they made the decision and they took that action is what you're saying. But was it their idea to single out Nehemiah to represent this
well, no,
this
I mean, no, because Nehemiah, well, it was mine, because Keith was doing this program on the name of Yehovah on the authority of the Aleppo Codex, and I'm going, you know what, that's a very small part of the story. When, you know, you have to understand that my background, my grandfather, for instance, in the 1940s became a Netzri believer. And for 50 years, he studied. He became a very strong advocate for Torah, for Yeshua, and in the Jewish and Christian world, for us to return to the faith once delivered.
Mm.
And so I've, you know, for three generations, I've been part of hearing the textual criticism and the comparative analysis of the different texts and the authority of the text and also all of the stuff about the different pronunciations of the name and different people's ideas how it should be pronounced.
Sure.
And to me that's a whole, it can be a real huge confusing thing for a lot of people who don't understand how the different texts are used and where people get the authority from. You know, to make such decisions on pronunciation, et cetera, that, you know, most people are not aware that there's ancient languages that retain the vowel sounds within their texts, and so So I was, you know, I suggested, why not bring the whole family of texts together and teach some textual criticism and give some background, rather than just having one person teach as though there's only one authoritative text or one way of explaining it.
But obviously, you know, there are different teachers who teach their understanding of different pronunciations, and there's a plethora to choose from. Obviously, mm-hmm. why is this one so dangerous?
What do you mean dangerous? In the sense of what dangerous?
Well, I guess in the sense that we're talking about you mentioned Yehovah, the pronunciation, and so on and so forth, based on the Aleppo Codex and the Leningrad Codex. Why is it that? Do you think that GLC would pull a program that was in the middle of its series in order to bring about this what Nehemiah Gordon is referring to as a disputation? It almost seems like, you know, you've done all this work. Now that you put in the effort, we're going to dangle the carrot to get your friend to come on and make him do something. And it just seems a little bit odd, because there are other teachers that teach different pronunciations that aren't being called into question. There's also other teachers on GLC that uphold the Aleppo and the Leningrad that aren't being pulled into question.
Of course.
Why is Nehemiah being singled out? It's just a bit beyond me.
Well, I thought I'd explain that. Let me try to... The connection between the Shem Tov manuscript and the Aleppo is from, you know, the 14th century. Mm-hmm. The ideas that they generate together as authoritative texts can create an ideas that are anti-Mashiach. And you know, if Andrew Gabriel Roth or many other scholars will do a far better job of explaining this than I. You know, I sit at their feet and I learn from them, and sure. Peter Flint and Marty Abeg, and I've heard the discussions. And so
okay, so I guess because he is, I guess maybe you might recognize Nehemiah as the forefront voice for Shem Tov Hebrew Matthew at the moment.
Certainly he is. Yeah, he is.
Why you would want. Now, I guess my next question is then, you said that the challenge to debate Andrew was purely about textual criticism, not faith. But if the Masoretic text is anti-Yeshua in conjunction with the Shem Tov Hebrew Matthew, as you claim, how can there be a debate about the validity of the Masoretic text without really being a debate about belief in Yeshua?
I don't know of anybody that would say that the Masoretic text is anti-Mashiach, is anti-Messiah. That's absolutely not a true statement. But on specific points where it really matters, there's defining points where it really matters. On those points, arguments
on those
need
points, those particular passages.
Okay? There's no way you're going to pay me, or anybody else is going to pay me, into a corner to say that the Aleppo or the Leningrad, or, you know, that we should throw them out of the synagogues. That is not going to happen.
No. And that's not what I'm getting from you, but I've obviously misrepresented your words. And perhaps if I say it this way, and you let me know if this is fair, that there are certain passages, certain aspects of the Masoretic texts that have anti-Yeshua characteristics that seem to concur with Shem Tov Hebrew Matthew. Is that a fair way of saying it?
Correct.
Okay,
yeah.
And so I go back to my question: how then does such a debate not filter down to a debate about belief in Yeshua?
Well, that is also an issue, of course. But
sure.
That, you know, and that's something that I wrote about as well, posted on the website about a situation where TC, which I didn't mention his name, mm-hmm. Who I never heard a reply back from Nehemiah yet, but I was in Jerusalem. TC was in my apartment. He was baptized in 2009. He had been searching and was baptized in the Jordan, and we had a very good relationship. And then within in Pesach, he refused to visit my apartment in Jerusalem come Pesach, because he had now decided to convert to become a Karaite.
Right.
And I couldn't even have a dialogue with him. He refused. He was told that he couldn't dialogue with me.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously, I don't know to this day what convinced him to leave his faith in Yeshua. I would like to know. I'd like to have a dialogue with him. You know?
I think what you wrote, Baruch, in this is page five of your article, you wrote, I was present when Mr. Roth baptized a man named T.C., and I was present when the same man ridiculed the name of Yeshua to the dirt because of hanging around Mr. Nehemiah Gordon and his Karaite buddies. Mr. Now, do you know that for sure? I mean, do you know that he was hanging around Nehemiah Gordon?
I only know is that's what he told me.
He told you that he was hanging around with Nehemiah Gordon.
And the group in Jerusalem. Can
I just be specific? T.C. told you that he was hanging around with Nehemiah Gordon.
That he was under the Karaite authority, and Nehemiah Gordon was the, he'd been reading Nehemiah's material.
He was reading his material. Can I be absolutely specific? Did T.C. tell you that he was in company with, physically hanging out with Nehemiah Gordon?
Yes.
The answer is yes.
The answer is yes. At the time, I was there. And of course, that's his liberty, everybody has the path they're going to walk. I was disappointed and sad that he was told that he couldn't talk to me anymore. I set lunch appointments with him that he canceled, and I think maybe four or five times we set appointments, and then he was in a place of struggling with his faith and his identity, and I've been told the Karaites are doing conversions, and hopefully one day those conversions will stand in Israel for people to live in the land of Israel. And this particular brother was interested in living in Israel. Okay, so was
T.C. Would you say he was a Nazir, or he was a Christian? How would you define him?
Well, we had developed a relationship over the internet, and he was becoming Torah observant, and I would define him as a Netzeri. I don't even like calling myself Netzeri sometimes, because I think of how we are approaching the faith which was once delivered. We're living in it, yes, but there's elements of our faith as a body that the unity of the body, the unity of the faith, that I think we've got a long ways to go.
Because you go on in that same paragraph, you go on to say, Mr. Gordon claims that he is not responsible for any Christians leaving their faith, but I know that to be, you're right, I know that to be a bald-faced lie. And you base that on one testimony. This is T.C. Is there another witness to this?
I've asked others who I put out back in 2010. I sent a few emails around and I asked anybody, if you know somebody, a family member who's left their faith in Yeshua, become Karaite, I would like to know about them, who they are, if they'd like to dialogue with me, or whatever the case may be. When I heard back, I don't have the time to go to every situation and find out the whole story. That's why I asked Nehemiah to speak with me directly.
I guess what I'm saying, Baruch, is do you have a second witness? You do. You have at least two.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, we do, unfortunately, which I'm very sad to say. I don't hold that against Nehemiah. If he's teaching somewhere in a congregation and somebody feels drawn to the Karaite faith, well, it's not really his responsibility if a person, chooses to convert to, Karaism, if that's what they want to do. That's their choice. But with this particular situation, I thought, I've never been invited to a Karaite meeting in Jerusalem. I've, like I said, I had a Karaite roommate. I've met numbers of them over the years.
Sure.
I think that, fair is fair, Andrew hasn't been invited to go around to speak at different Karaite groups, and I don't know any other Torah teachers that have been invited to go around and speak in Karaite communities, and I think that would be equality and fair for everybody if we had common considerations in that regards. So, when I put that out and I asked other people, there was others who said, that yes, this has happened, and nobody was pointing their fingers at Nehemiah per se. I think he is very highly respected, in that regard. But but I had that experience I had. And there's, when I asked others if they know of somebody, or if, then I've heard witnesses come back, which I think would, I think it's only fair to bring them forward if they want to and explain their testimony, why they left the faith of Yeshua. I know several pastors that I, over the years growing up, who left, Christian pastors who left their both Messianic faith and Christian faith and converted to different elements of Judaism. You know, it's not my business if somebody else makes that choice. But
I understand what you're saying, and obviously we should have a reason ready to give an answer for what we believe. Correct? I mean, it's probably a good thing that we be challenged from time to time, and we certainly should know why we believe what we believe. But can I ask you, Brooke? These two witnesses that you claim to have, have you made Nehemiah aware of these?
Well, he won't dialogue.
Have you sent him an email in regards to them?
Yeah, I have. I've asked him about TC. I've asked him about somebody else, and he doesn't feel he needs to get back with me. And that's
the two witnesses then, the TC and the other person. That's fair. So can I suggest? Well, I won't suggest. I'll tell you, because I have had conversations with Nehemiah regarding this, and I wanted to check it with you before we mentioned it on air. But TC, you gave him the name of those initials. He's never heard of the individual. He can't find any information on the individual. He's been speaking to Karaites, writing to them saying, please, have you heard of this person? Has anyone ever tried to talk this chap out of his faith? Because, of course, you understand that Nehemiah certainly insists that he has never, ever tried to do any such thing. The other person that you made him aware of, he got into contact with.
Before you go on to the other person,
please.
TC changed his name, and I kept this private because I wanted him to discuss it with me. Why do we have to go on public broadcast to discuss this?
Because if an accusation has been made that can't be backed up, I mean, why would you give Nehemiah a name that has been changed? Surely he knew TC by the name that you gave him.
I don't know. I sent him a private email. I sent him a private email.
And you gave him the name of the initials TC.
No, I spelled out his full name.
Yeah, that's
so
right.
He would know.
Yeah, that's right. That's what I mean.
So and the other person that you're just about to mention, go ahead with that, and I know who it is already as well. Go ahead.
I know you do, sir, but I won't mention the name if that's okay. Let's keep that name confidential.
Absolutely.
But it would be worth noting that Nehemiah has spoken to the spouse of the individual who has spoken to the individual that you mentioned and insists that that is not the case. So he's been in touch personally with that one, and by their own mouth, they are saying that that is not the case, what you claim to be.
True. And that's a true statement. I was told different information about that spouse when I first heard about it.
Sure.
And then what happened, Nehemiah called that person.
So you've been given misinformation.
That was a case of misinformation.
Sure.
But then I got another phone call.
Uh huh.
So I don't know how many phone calls I'm going to get. The point is, you know, many people have reached out to Nehemiah in these situations just for clarification, right? And somebody emailed me his newsletter here, and he started talking about Andrew as the converted Aramaic Jew all the way through. I think what he mentions, it's something like, I don't know how many, 11 times or something. I'm just going through his notes here.
Sure.
And the level of disrespect in this, do you want me to go over with you the level of disrespect in this newsletter that he put out?
Well,
that told me that, hey, what's up with that? You know,
I guess,
you know,
before
how,
we do,
you know,
talk
what
about
it means?
The level of disrespect, if I may just clarify, even though you received further information regarding the second witness that was not the case, you're still claiming that you have another second witness?
There's a third witness.
Okay, but Nehemiah obviously is not aware of this third witness.
I don't know if he is or not. Don't know. I mean, how do I know how many people that Nehemiah knows?
What I mean, I'm sorry, Baruch, you haven't brought this particular person to his attention as you have the other two. Now you mentioned, Baruch, in this article, that what you were hoping for from both Nehemiah and from Andrew Gabriel Roth was a gentlemanly discussion or a gentlemanly debate. Is that fair?
Like those questions that I asked Nehemiah back last year, that he still hasn't answered. Mm. I'm thinking, well, if somebody asked me and they're interested, I would answer them. And to actually have coming from his mouth, I think it's only fair to get those textual things from his mouth. And also, at that point, it would be nice to discuss some of these other more interpersonal things that happened, that have happened in this last few years.
Sure.
Okay, so the question is I have is, why is the Shem Tov being elevated as an authoritative New Testament text by a guy who doesn't believe in the author, doesn't believe in Yeshua, doesn't believe the Shulchim, doesn't believe the message of the good news himself?
Mm-hmm.
And I just, you know, if he thinks that that's Jew bashing, or that that's being anti-Semitic, or that's making him put a yellow star on his body, I'm thinking, dude, like, we're all Jews. Everybody, you know, in Nazi press happens to be Jewish, and we happen to would like to know if you know, the Karaites have more information on in their own history and in their own halacha, their own specific goals, their spirituality, to add to the whole picture of spirituality.
Mm. Is it fair to ask, Pablo Cristiani, was he Jewish?
Doesn't sound Jewish to me, does he?
Okay. You don't okay. My understanding was that Pablo Cristiani was Jewish.
Yeah, he was Jewish, but he obviously was a convert. Right? And that was the big argument is, you know, listen, when people say they're Jewish, what does that mean? What does it mean to be a Jew? I'm gonna define it differently than Nehemiah is.
Okay.
A Jew who's one inwardly.
Mm-hmm.
And so the whole idea of in my faith, Yeshua is the king of the Yehudim. He's the king of the Jews. So he expresses the quintessential Jew for what a Jew should be.
Mm.
Right? So that when somebody converts to Catholicism and they do not do Torah, and they're not Torah observant, they're not Shomer Shabbat, they're not Shomer Mitzvot, I'm going, okay, you have some blood flowing through you, some Jewish blood flowing through you. But living the Jewish faith, the Jewish lifestyle,
sure,
is what maintains Jewish, you know, Torah-based Jewish identity. And Yahweh says, if you don't maintain that Torah-based identity, I'll scrape you off the land. You will not inhabit the land. I'll scrape the temple off Jerusalem. So, you know, why I'm saying that is this Jewish identity is a religion within itself. Mm-hmm. For many Jews.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't, you know, whether Pablo Cristiani, if he's from Jewish extraction, that really doesn't make a whole lot of difference to me.
Maybe, you know, not just to you, like, but when would it be fair, Baruch, to say that it makes a difference to Nehemiah? Because you were saying, obviously, everyone at Netzari Press are of Jewish extraction, but so too, as Nehemiah, looking at this as a disputation, his friend's show has been cancelled, and there's an ultimatum given saying, unless you get Nehemiah to debate the convert, the Jewish convert, then nothing is going to go on air for you, and everything that you've done is kaput. So really, isn't it fair? I mean, when you look at famous disputations such as the one involving Pablo Cristiani, from Nehemiah's perspective, is that not valid because he was Jewish?
Well, I have all the dialogue here. I've got all of the original emails written between the television station and Keith.
Uh-huh.
And I fail to see how they could arrive, Keith and Nehemiah could arrive at the conclusions that they arrived at from the dialogue that was put before them.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And so I thought, wow, this is just masking the real issues here. We're not getting to the issues if you're going to say that, oh, you feel you're persecuted. I mean, I go, how's that? I mean, GLC brings him in. They use their whole platform, their television platform, to welcome him.
Mm.
And they pay for his hotel. They pay for his dinners.
Mm.
And they treat him like gold. They treat everybody. Their hospitality is remarkable.
Mm. Mm.
And that's really why I got my dander up. Also, when I read his letter, I thought, why are you treating these people this way and raising the level of acrimony and using the word disputation to the level that you're doing it? I fail to see that.
You don't see it?
And even with, I fail to see it, even with Keith. I mean, pay his airfare, bring him onto the station, pay for his food, his motel, and everything, take care of him, treat him, you know. I've never heard a disparaging word about these two brothers.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I haven't heard that from the staff and the people at GLC. And so, you know, what was I to do when I get this newsletter sent to me that Nehemiah writes that, you know, that's got all this stuff in it that I'm going, I don't connect the dots here, dear Nehemiah. You know, how you could feel that you got so emotionally distraught that you would compare it to something like I don't know here, probably have to check my notes to quote them correctly, but something like going through, you know, some sort of a Holocaust denier. Yeah, that's he said something about that it was like being around somebody who denied the Holocaust. No, don't quote me on that, but I, whether it was on the radio or here, but I remember hearing that thinking, my goodness. You know, and I've got the notes here. I don't know how much time we have to go through this, and I don't personally want to. But there's a whole bunch of ultimatums that he gives, you know, against Andrew. That I thought, Nehemiah, you sat down with Andrew Gabriel Roth. You had dinner with us twice. Mm. You know his name, right? And there was some lively debate there in Salem. But why all of a sudden the slur? Why the converted Aramaic Jew? Why the slur? Why the derogatory comments?
Sure. So you see that you really take offense to that and see the quote-unquote converted Aramaic Jew as a slur.
It's a slur. Listen, I wouldn't call you...
It's not respectful. Of course it's not. And it's derogatory.
It's a shame. It's a terrible thing. If I know your name, you know, and I have dinner with you and you're Jono, And then I turn and called you something that was distasteful, the Jewish, that the whole world knows is a distasteful saying, and don't refer to you by your, you know, Yahweh given name. I mean, you know, the funny thing is ever since I've known Andrew, he's got a saying. He says the only thing I convert is rice. You know.
Okay. Well, if I may, Baruch, because now I'm particularly confused, and perhaps you can enlighten me. You wrote, "Gee, it just occurred to me that NG's initials stand for no good. Wow,
okay,
I hope
okay.
his
I took,
name
I took
isn't
that off.
Fred.
I took it off. I took it off.
Oh, you took it off. Okay, so you
yeah, it's not. It's not
hindsight.
There. I was mad. I was okay. upset, and I took it off.
In hindsight, you took that off.
Yeah, I was gonna.
Can I ask you? Did you take this off? You wrote, Mr. Root is apparently making a marketing TV sort of Ephraimite evangelist, high promotion money making guy who used Mr. Nehemiah Gordon as his Hebrew scholar. You took that off too.
I took it off the next day.
And then dropped him off inside the household of faith to be later adopted and loved by Mr. Keith Johnson. I'm glad you took that off.
Okay, maybe I didn't take that one off, but I thought that was nice to be loved by the. When I got the newsletter. I wrote it, and then I thought, you know what? I'm just going.
And as I said at the beginning of the interview, it reads like an emotive and impulsive response, which I think is a fair description. You also wrote, what? Mr. Johnson, simply tarry a bit too long in a cheap Mexican joint on the road out of town.
Yeah,
this is in regards. Oh, you took that off.
You know what?
You must have been.
You must have got that within about less than 5 or 6 hours of me posting that. Because
okay. You took that off.
All that was. I'm, you know, okay. There you go. It's all that venting. You have access to it.
Well, all that venting you put on the internet.
Yeah, I did. Yeah, it was there for about 5 or 6 hours, and then I took it off. And I thought, you know what? I'm not going to fight.
Now,
Nehemiah.
Is this part of your character? Because I mean, you put a couple of comments on my website, and then later on, it was that you came back on and you said, "Truth be told, I feel that Laura and David are correct in their reproof of what I wrote. I apologize for that attitude that came out in my previous posts. I make this apology to each one, and I really do appreciate it. But sir, when we talk about disparaging comments, when we talk about respect and we talk about derogative comments and things like that, you're certainly not in the clear here by any means. Is that fair to say?
No, no, that's true. That's right. True. I was very upset, and I just okay. even going through my notes now and look what I've highlighted. I'm going, you know what? I didn't make that public apology on your website.
And I appreciate that.
It wasn't just for myself. It was for others that were indicted here. And
let's move past that then. I appreciate what you're saying. I guess if we could start to wrap this up, can I ask you, what would you like to see? How would you like to see this end? How would you like to see this wrap up, ideally, this whole situation?
Well, you know, specifically on the levels of textual criticism of Shemtov, of you know, I'd like to see whatever Nehemiah has, any scholarly works on Shemtov and why he holds dear to it being a, you know, not a translation, and this long, however he puts it, you know, extensive history that that he claims. I would be delighted to know what that is and hear that from his perspective.
Sure.
And I'd like to, you know, have him make comments on specific elements of the Aleppo that and Leningrad has compared to the Septuagint and to the Dead Sea Scrolls. I've also found on a Karaite website. I was just looking, and there was an interesting connection with Kahana, a Karaite, who's an author, researcher, scientist, and historian, who speaks of following the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls, which are often in agreement with the Samaritan version of Torah, it became somewhat more evident that the Masoretic text may have been the one that had changed. And he says of approximately 6,000 instances in which the Samaritan and the Masoretic text differ, the Septuagint version agrees with the Samaritan on 2,000 of those cases. So I thought, well, I'd like to know what those cases are. I'd like to know where they're cited. Yeah. I couldn't find anything about that. On Karaite websites.
Sure.
And
well, that sounds like an excellent topic for conversation. That's very interesting.
Right. So the other things, you know, it'd be nice if we could have dialogue, you know, next time I'm in Jerusalem, if it's possible. I would welcome it. Just man to man would be nice. And I really thought that was happening in Salem when we were having dinner together. So reading all this stuff that came out, I do apologize. I was shocked and I was sad and I thought, wow, you know, and I've written a bunch of notes. I guess it's not worth to go through it, but I thought perhaps one day maybe Keith and Nehemiah and I can look over and sit down and forgive and forget and give each other a big hug. You know?
Of course. And so obviously the ideal situation is reconciliation and
absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. That's great. And that's great to hear that from you too. Well, my friend, we have come to the end of our time, and I appreciate you. I do appreciate your time, and I know I've given you some difficult questions, but I will just say that you've had equal time as well to the response to Keith and Nehemiah speaking last week. And I would just like to remind listeners that the website is aent.org in regards to the Aramaic English New Testament by Andrew Gabriel Roth. And the other website, Baruch?
Hebrew New Testament.
Hebrew New Testament.
Hebrew New Testament and Wheel of Stars, if you're interested in the calendar.
This Wheel of Stars also. Excellent. All right, my friend. I appreciate your time. Thank you so much for coming on to Truth to You. In the meantime, listeners, be blessed, be set apart by the truth of the Father's Word. Shalom.